evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Government took the very difficult decision of suspending Madam Lara Delapia.
The Sierra Leonean government announces a team to investigate allegations of impropriety and professional misconduct against the Auditor General and Deputy.
To transform their country, that is to address all the injustices of the past.
The Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission, or TRRC, hands over its final report to the Gambian President, Adama Barrow.
For the fact that women and youth have not been nominated or appointed as constitutional provision.
And women's and civil society groups say they are unhappy with the low numbers of youth and women currently serving in the Zambian government. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Sierra Leone, the government has announced a team to investigate allegations of impropriety and professional misconduct against the Auditor General and Deputy. This after the administration suspended Madam Lara Taylor-Pierce and her deputy Tamba Momu over the allegations. Information Minister Mohamed Rahman Soare says the outcome of the independent investigation will determine the government's next line of action. But critics are condemning the suspension, saying the move was a constitutional violation aimed at hampering transparency and accountability in public finance management. They also contend that the two senior auditors were suspended after investigating allegations of corruption in the office of both President Julius Mada Bio and First Lady Fatima Mada Bio. To learn more about the government's decision to suspend the two prominent auditors, I reached Sierra Leonean Information Minister Mohamed Rahman Soare.
Government took the very difficult decision of suspending Madam Lara Taylor-Pierce and her deputy following very consistent, persistent and recurrent complaints of professional misconduct on their part. As provided for in the 1991 Constitution, governments had to do the necessary thing. We are talking about an Auditor General who is supposed to maintain professional confidentiality, who is supposed to respect the Public Financial Management Act, who is supposed to maintain the highest ethical principles. You know, but all of these have come under serious questions in recent times by members of the public and by key institutions. So government needed to take the right decision to put them on administrative suspension and set up a three-member tribunal so that they could look into the allegations.
Some civil society organizations and some pro-democracy activists said the indefinite suspension of these two senior officials are a constitutional violation and a move to hamper transparency and accountability in public finance management. How do you respond to that?
I mean, I can only shrug that off, because in the history of this country, President Bio's government has given more support to the office of the Auditor General than any other government before her. We have literally quadrupled the support the Auditor General's office had had. By her own admission, this government has implemented more audit recommendations than any other before her. So we continue to pride ourselves as a government that believes in the values of transparency and accountability, and the whole world has recognized this, including the United States government's Millennium Challenge Corporation.
What do you say to critics who are of the view that these things are mere allegations to tarnish the reputation of the Auditor General, who has served since 2012 with distinction and has exposed a lot of public corruption, corruption of which the president has vowed to fight? So the allegations are made to just get her out of office, and the government is erring by indefinitely suspending her. How do you respond to that?
President Bio's government has an insatiable thirst and hunger for more and more accountability. He always says government should yearn for more transparency and accountability and not less. So that is to tell you the level of commitment of his administration. To suggest that government will devote all her time and effort to handing Laura to Las Piers is, I mean, quite unfortunate. This government has more critical things to think about. The fact of the matter is we are merely calling for evenness, fairness, and ensuring that what is good for the goose is good for the gander.
Opposition groups are saying that the Auditor General came under criticism following a report in financial year 2020 that they said highlighted financial and procurement irregularities while auditing details of the president's travel expenditures and procurement activities of the Office of the First Lady. And because of some of these, you know, details of forgery of receipts, among other inconsistencies, that is why they got themselves into trouble. How do you address such criticism?
It is a known fact that the opposition will say anything, right? If we had not done what we have done this time, if we did it earlier, they would have said that it's because we do not want Lara to audit the accounts of government. Now that we've done it this time, they are contriving all kinds of conspiracy theories. But that is what it is. The fact of the matter remains, this is exactly part of the reason why this tribunal has been set up. The audit reports are not officially published yet. So to an extent that the opposition is able to talk about key and critical issues therein means Lara Taylor Pierce has breached a major facet of the trust of her office, which is maintaining official of confidentiality. As government, we do not, at this point, know what is contained in the 2020 audit. But like we say, this is all the more reason why we think public trust and confidentiality has been breached, and for the same reason that Lara must have had it before the tribunal.
Mohammed Rahman Soare is a Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. In the Gambia, the Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission, or TRRC, has handed over its final report to President Adama Barrow. A top official of the board says those who are responsible for crimes and gross violation of human and civil rights should be prosecuted under the full force of the law. The TRRC was established to look into alleged violations during over two decades of rule by former President Yahya Jammeh. Local media reports the president has a month to study the document and outline measures his administration plans to take to implement recommendations contained in it. Its publication comes as Gambians get ready to go to the polls to choose a new leader. Analysts say the study will force the presidential candidate to highlight their plans to address issues of justice for the victims of the violations and crimes committed during Jammeh's rule before the presidential election. Madi Jobate is a prominent Gambian human rights defender. He tells me that incumbent President Adama Barrow should make the TRRC findings available to all citizens.
It's really significant because it has exposed Gambia to the truth, at least through the public hearings, but also with the report, it has formalized these things into a document, into a tool, which would now be utilized by the government, by the people of the Gambia, to transform their country, that is to address all the injustices of the past, as well as to set up new systems, structures, processes, and to abandon all the vestiges of the past in order to create a new society altogether. So in that regard, the submission of the report today, after that law exercise of fact-finding of what happened in the past, is really significant.
Madi, the president has about a month to study the report and then outline plans to implement the recommendations contained in the report within 6 months. Critics of the president say victims of atrocities committed during Yahya Jammeh's reign have not been properly compensated or even taken care of. What's your take?
The government did provide some temporary compensation or reparations by providing $15 million, about $1 million, at the TRRC since last year, which has served to address some of the needs of the victims. But of course, this is hugely inadequate. So we look forward to see how much government would put into reparations, bearing in mind that the recently passed 2022 budget, the Minister of Justice said that is about $3 million, have been allocated for that, which is still very inadequate. At the beginning of your question, you mentioned this issue of 6 months that he has to produce a white paper. But I've just been engaging on social media to say the citizens have a right to see and receive and read this report in full. This report is about the people of the Gambia. It was the people of the Gambia who went out to testify, to give information. It was the people of the Gambia who suffered. And the TRRC is a public institution. And so this report is a public document that all Gambians need to see and receive and read. Because the implementation is not purely the monopoly of the government, but each and every Gambian has a role to play in the implementation of this report, particularly the recommendations. And so according to the TRRC Act, the government is required within 1 month, the president, to submit the full report to the National Assembly and to the UN Secretary General. But after that, the president is required to share this report in full or make summaries of it to the general public. I mean, I am advocating that the president should rather release the full report to all Gambians to read, to know, to understand how we will all support the implementation, but also to draw lessons for our own personal conduct, personal behavior, whether we are private citizens or public officials or security officers, to learn from the testimonies that are in the report. So it is important that the document really is shared with each and every Gambian in full.
With the elections just around the corner, some people are suggesting that justice for victims of human rights violations should be at the forefront during this campaign process in the run-up to the elections. What are your thoughts?
Well, definitely. I think I've argued many times that this report will make or break the Gambia. And there's enough experience around the world what happens to a society that fails to implement in full, in an inclusive, transparent, efficient manner, truth commission reports. And so the elections is near, it's almost here. I know some of the parties or the candidates are talking about accountability for this report. But it should be a top subject for each and every candidate, because it is not merely about prosecutions and reparations to end impunity, but the report is also proposing fundamental constitutional reforms, legal reforms, and reforms within our socio-political, socio-cultural setup in view of what happened in the past in order for us to build a more equal and just society. So I've seen all the manifestos of most of the candidates, and I've listened to them. And I'm sure whatever is in that manifestos and whatever campaign promise they give would fit quite well with the recommendations that are in this report. But this report should be singled out as a top agenda for any candidate to ensure that we take it with the utmost urgency and to implement it as soon as possible.
Madi Jobate is a prominent Gambian human rights defender. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. In Senegal, a 3-day workshop for civil society groups and NGOs in West Africa is underway in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Officials say the workshop, organized by the Trade Facilitation West Africa Project, aims to promote trade by strengthening the participation of civil society and other stakeholders in the effort. It also seeks to improve intra-regional trade and related exchanges between West Africa and other parts of the continent. This, as experts worry, that trade within West Africa is mostly informal, with intra-Africa business representing only between 11 to 15% of all trade. Paul Ijeme is a global analyst and a presenter at the three-day workshop for civil society and NGOs. He tells me that the workshop presents an opportunity for the participants to share ideas and experiences needed to form strategic alliances and partnerships that are inclusive, sustainable, and results-oriented.
This workshop, it tries to give skills and tools, relevant tools to the CSOs to be able to engage in trade facilitation advocacy. That is what will be the orientation and what will they want from the trade in West Africa. For now, it is largely informal trade and intra-regional trade. You know, is just hovering between 11% and 15%. That is intra-regional. They trade more with outside world than they do among themselves, which is not a good thing. So they are trying, even those that one that they are trading with the outside world, to focus it in a way that it brings they maximize leverage, the profit from it, instead of being exploited or just engaging in partnership trade that do not really help the citizens of the community. So this workshop is trying to build the capacity of civil society and then amplify or enhance their voices in the dialogues and the engagement of trade facilitation.
Paul, you were one of the presenters at this conference. What specifically did you talk to these CSOs and NGOs about briefly?
Yeah, my presentation was on building and reconstructing alliances and partnerships in advocacy. Because it's not enough to say you want to advocate, you want to know what you're advocating for, with whom you're advocating, and to whom you are advocating. So you need now to calibrate it in a way that it will be effective, it will be impactful, and then yield result-oriented. So that was what I shared with them, and then they also brought experiences and then the ideas of how what they have experienced along the borders or in trying to get the policies. ECOWAS has the trade liberalization policy. ECOWAS has the protocol on free movement of goods and services and people, and so on and so forth. And then there is also this continental African trade area. So how can this civil society or non-state actors or the private sector, how can they pitch in? How can they maximize their participation? It's not enough to just sit down and let things fly by. They have to be participants. They are not observers. They have to be real observers to be able to participate and make sure that they benefit from there, both at the national level and then at the regional level. That is what workshop is all about.
So basically, the workshop is about them not being spectators, but active participants. But let me ask you, what do you think are the major takeaways for these NGOs and CSOs in the advocacy work within the sub-region in West Africa?
They are going to come out with the CSO position. For instance, on the institutional reform that is taking place in the ECOWAS. And so, and address, you know, all from the presentations, then pick out things that they need to do to first focus their advocacy in terms of on trade facilitation to be able to maximize their benefits. So that is the whole idea, that they build the capacity, strengthen the capacity, and then be able to use it to advocate for the kind of trade engagements and their businesses exchanges that will benefit community citizens at the national and then the regional level. And then at the same time also see what alliances can be built between one region and the other within the region, and with the hope of increasing the volume and the value. You know, what happens in trade is a lot from the farmers, from those petit traders, and then the real big guns, those private sector big players. I think civil society has to pitch in. They have to put their, you know, establish their their foothold in a way that it is not just a government thing, because government alone cannot do it. You know what it is. There is poverty, there is insecurity, there is so much that is interfering with economic development in West Africa.
Paul Ijeme is a global analyst and a presenter at the three-day workshop for civil society and NGOs. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. In Uganda, the Inspector General of Government is calling the country's broadcasters to help in the fight against corruption. Miss Betty Kamya says she plans to adopt a new strategy in that fight in the East African country. Calling the broadcasters to help in the anti-graft crusade, Miss Kamya says her organization plans to adopt a strategy based more on prevention than cure in the effort to fight against fraud and corruption. Her remarks come after her agency announced an investigation into the wealth and lifestyles of more than 200 public officials. But critics say the call on broadcasters to help is not likely to succeed. They contend that only low-ranking public officials may be affected by the anti-corruption crusade. They also say investigative journalists have been targeted by state actors using intimidation and harassment. This makes it difficult for broadcasters to help since they will be exposed and their security put at risk. Robert Sempala is the executive director, Human Rights Network for Uganda Journalists. He tells me that state institutions have not allowed journalists to freely operate and to help expose alleged corruption among public officials.
It is a very good call from such a high government personality, but it doesn't tally well with the ongoing in the country, because recently two journalists were in cells held in Comunicado for over a week because of writing about the corruption tendencies that are allegedly involving the Deputy Speaker of Parliament. They were tortured and they are charged with very frivolous charges. Recently, we had one of our own, Siraja Solomon, who was working with a prominent TV station in India, whose wife was arrested because the husband was investigating the underhand ways of siphoning government drugs from health facilities to private ventures. And other reporters were held equally liable for investigating a story. So you do not really see that... this call is genuine.
Is there a way you can engage Ms. Kamya, since she is the Inspector General of Government? Perhaps there could be some protection, or she could find a way where some of these journalists will not be victimized?
This would happen if we had a witness protection law. That would help a little bit, but here, all we see is security trying to force the investigative journalists that have exposed the seemingly corrupt government officials for release, reveal their sources. And that is extremely counterproductive to such a call by the IGG.
Well, Robert, some journalists that I spoke with say that although the call is welcome, it's impractical because there have been instances where state actors have attempted to spy recently on investigative journalists and some politicians in the country. So it's very difficult for people to show face and help in the fight against corruption, knowing that there could be a backlash. What is your take?
That's exactly very true. Where you know that Big Brother is watching, not for good intentions, but for purposes of trying to dig out criminal tendencies within your work, no journalists want to take their jobs or even their lives to be answering charges in courts of law because they have done, they have jumped onto a wagon which they do not know where it is going, because the very Inspector General of Government really knows that many journalists that have been even brought to, taken to court have only been doing their work, but government has not come out to defend them. Government has not come out to issue any statement to the effect that those journalists should be left to do their work. Instead, they have gone on to victimize the entire media industry as they are being anti-government, being opposition, because of doing such work. Recently, the media also talked about one of the presidential personalities in the aid COVID, Dr. Mosenelo, and he came out and said, no, you should not accuse her of any corruption because she's a scientist. She's doing a lot of good work. So such statements are extremely counterproductive to a call by the IGG to involve the media, let alone individual journalists. I know that if any journalist goes that way, they will really have to suffer the consequences at some point. So journalists should really go slow on this and make sure that the environment is conducive for them. If not, then they'd rather concentrate and do other things. If anything, they should do investigative work, but not because there was a call by the IGG to expose the corrupt.
So what is the way forward in this call for journalists to help in the fight against corruption in Uganda? Because obviously, it looks like the Inspector General of Government needs help.
Yeah, certainly. The Inspector General of Government needs to hold some sensitization meetings to engage the security, to impress it upon them that journalists are a very good vehicle for exposing the corrupt and gross abuse of office and power. And as such, the journalists will be encouraged basing on those levels of interaction. She should also bring together journalists and the security forces to appreciate and cultivate a conducive working environment that can lead into working together to expose the corrupt. Short of that, then it's not the best timing for the IGG to think that the journalists are going to do this work as though all is well and normal.
Robert Sampala is the Executive Director, Human Rights Network for Uganda Journalists. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Still in Uganda, investigative journalist Raymond Mujuni says he has received warnings from Apple that his iPhone is being targeted by a spyware called Pegasus. Politician and lawyer Norbert Mao, who is leader of the opposition Democratic Party, or DP, says he has received a similar warning that his iPhone is being targeted by the same spyware. Experts say Pegasus can allow the operator to extract information including messages, pictures, phone call records, and emails. It also has the ability to control cameras and microphones of infected electronic gadgets such as cell phones. Investigative journalist Raymond Mujuni says it appears he was targeted due to his work. He adds that other investigative journalists he contacted also say they have received warnings that their phones are being targeted by state actors using Pegasus. Mr. Mujuni tells me that he has taken measures to protect his electronic gadgets from the spyware.
Yesterday, I got messages. One was an email update from Apple itself, indicating that my phone had been targeted by state-backed actors for hacking. And another was a follow-up text message indicating the same too. The email says that I'm being targeted because of the kind of work that I do. And I'm an investigative journalist in Uganda, so I don't know why I'd fit the profile. But I've been taking steps to secure my phone and also to sort of learn new things about what this attack could mean for me, my devices, and the people that I've been speaking to.
Are you saying that you received a second notification after the first attempt?
Yeah, I received a second notification, which was basically Apple saying the attack is still ongoing, in the sense that Apple has been communicating that a group called NSO had supplied a software called Pegasus, and that software was being used to corrupt iPhones. And people whose iPhones had been targeted by this software are now being notified by both email and text message about the same. And that's the circumstance under which I also got notified.
Have you notified the authorities about this?
I haven't filed a formal case. We're still gathering as much information as we can. We're able to establish the links that had been sent, which links, had I clicked on them, would have affected my phone. So once we have the details all together, then I'll be able to file a formal complaint to the Uganda Police Force under the Criminal Investigations Directorate.
I understand some politicians and other investigative journalists were also targeted. Is it true?
Yeah, I've now learned one member of an opposition party was targeted by the same software, and two other investigative journalists that I know and who I've worked with previously who are also targeted and received the same message as I got.
With the steps that you've taken, do you think that will be enough to protect you from these attempted attacks?
Well, the steps would secure the devices that we have, but they wouldn't stop the people that are carrying out the phishing attacks from continuing to try and break into what should be confidential information that we have in our position as journalists. And that's why the appeal has been very broad to have only the legal surveillance regime. And that legal surveillance regime requires the government of Uganda to go before a court of law and explain the circumstances under which they'd like to survey my phone to a high court judge, which judge would then permit that surveillance to happen. None of the of that has happened in my case or in the case of the journalists that I've heard from and the leader of one of the members in the opposition parties who has complained about them happening to them.
Some people are suggesting that if those attempting to break into your phone are government actors, then even if you report it to the authorities, nothing might come out of it since the authority, so to speak, controls the levers of power. What are your thoughts?
That'd be perfectly true, of course, but the point of reporting so that you create a record of instances like this happening, this isn't the first time that journalists and particularly people of interest have been targeted with hacking and surveillance in Uganda. In 2014, I investigated and broke a story about the hacking team working in Uganda to sort of monitor devices of individuals that government thought were of interest. And a lot of this was still being done illegally.
Are you comparing notes with your fellow investigative journalists?
We've been speaking from Tuesday when we first got notified of the attacks. We've been speaking and putting together as much as we can and trying to learn as much as we can about the nature of the attack, the motives of the attackers, and what the information that they intend to gather, what they intend to use it for. So, yeah, in that regard, we're gathering as much information as we can, not to approach the authorities, but to also be able to report it to its full extent.
Raymond Mujuni is a Ugandan investigative journalist. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Kenya's Public Service Commission has launched a new fellowship for young civil servants. It forms part of the effort by the government to build an effective civil service. Officials say the program is an integral part of the plan to engage young people in public service and administration. The program is in partnership with two non-profit institutions, Emerging Public Leaders and the Emerging Leaders Foundation. Officials say the Public Service Emerging Leaders Fellowship of Kenya plans to help train 50 young civil servants to be future government leaders. They say the effort will focus on cultivating public sector-specific leadership, ethics, and the delivery of citizen-centered government. The fellowship, they add, includes year-round training, hands-on mentorship, community service, and continuous career development, as well as networking opportunities among Pan-African alumni. To learn more about Kenya's newly announced fellowship for young civil servants, I reach Yawa Hansen-Kwao, Executive Director at Emerging Public Leaders.
We formally launched the Public Service Emerging Leaders Fellowship Program of Kenya, and it's a partnership between my organization, Emerging Public Leaders, and a local organization known as the Emerging Leaders Foundation, and in partnership with the government of Kenya through the Public Services Commission. We have been on a journey over the past 2 years to design an initiative that would really support the government of Kenya's efforts at helping to upskill early stage public servants, giving them the ethical, strong bases that they need, giving them skills and connections to a Pan-African network of other civil servants with whom they can plan policies of the future that would really help address some of the global challenges.
Ms. Hansen-Kwao, what's the rationale behind this program and what does it entail?
Is a 12-month leadership development experience. that is really aimed at helping early stage public servants, particularly those who've been in public service for less than a year, gain the right orientation towards citizen centricism, to give them the right understanding of kind of global issues such as climate change and health pandemics and how to lead in times of uncertainty, but also give them the network, because it is cohort-based, a network of other like-minded public servants with whom they can kickstart their public service careers. We are noticing that the future of work is changing, and invariably the future of government work is also changing too. And as more countries are beginning to grapple with shared concerns and shared issues, it is just an important part of how we equip future public servants for, you know, the opportunity of leadership in such a time.
Talking about transformation, what do you think are some of the measures that could be implemented to ensure the program's success?
Well, we've taken a few steps to make sure this becomes an enduring effort. I think the first thing is partnerships, recognizing that we cannot do this alone. Emerging public leaders plays a catalytic role, but it really is the government of Kenya through the Public Services Commission that is leading the way here and really working with us to design an initiative that is fit for purpose. And so this curriculum is really focused on putting citizens at the center of public service and making sure that the 50 young people that will go through this inaugural cohort have the right orientation towards service, have the skills that they need to get their jobs done, have a network of mentors and coaches that will support their onward leadership journey, and that their onward continuous professional development will also be set on kind of a determined path. We recognize that every country needs its best and brightest in public service. And our vision is to really help governments to attract and retain excellent talent that are ethical and competent and will drive transformation.
What do you think are the prospects of these young people who go through this program? What are the prospects?
I think the future looks bright for young people in public service. Just last month in Accra, I joined 16 young, capable civil servants who graduated from our second cohort of public service fellows in Ghana. And already, many of them, before even graduating through the two-year fellowship in Ghana, have been promoted, they've risen through the ranks, they've been absorbed onto full-time public service, been roped into COVID response committees. Our fellows have worked on budgets, have been on the forefront of streamlining processes. And so we're finding that when we do invest in upskilling high-caliber talent, giving them the right orientation towards work, providing an architecture of support that includes mentoring and coaching. And as we foster these intergenerational relationships, we're seeing that there is such a great benefit. It recasts the image of public service in general, and more importantly, it helps governments deliver on their highest priorities. We had fellows in the Ministry of Health in Ghana, for example, who, because of the skills that they possessed, were roped into the Crisis Response Center and were really helping to, with their digital skills, to streamline the contact tracing process.
Yawa Hansen-Kwao is the executive director at Emerging Public Leaders. She spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Zambia, women's and civil society groups say they are not pleased with the low numbers of youth and women appointed to serve in government. This prompted three organizations to file suit against the government. They include the Chapter One Foundation, the NGO Coordinating Committee for Gender and Development, and Young Women in Action. The groups contend that the president's cabinet and parliamentary appointment do not meet gender and youth parity as enshrined in the constitution. They are asking the court to declare as unconstitutional the the composition of the cabinet and parliamentary appointment recently announced by the president after he won election in the August general poll. Critics say their groups are not likely to succeed since the president has the mandate to hire and fire whom he chooses to work with. But supporters of the groups say if the court petition fails, they will take the matter up to both the regional and continental judicial bodies and force the administration to respect the constitution. Harriet Chibuta, the executive director of Young Women in Action, tells me that the president should keep his oath to the country's founding legal document.
So the reason that we went to petition was for the fact that women and youth have not been nominated or appointed as the constitutional provision. I think from time immemorial, Zambia's governance structures have been dominated by men. Even if we have a constitutional provision that actually tells a nominating person or a person that has been given powers to appoint persons into public office to ensure that there is a 50-50 gender representation, first of all, but then also equitable representation of the youth as well as persons with disabilities. So because of that background and, you know, I think this is a... the fact that everybody knows, we've decided, you know, other methods of advocacy and so on have not worked, so we might as well take it in litigation-wise. So that is the reason we basically took it to the court.
But Harriet, some people are suggesting that it appears women groups and women activists like yourself are not giving the government enough time to... come up with a full list of appointment before going to court, and that you are jumping the gun too quickly.
I think that's a very terrible assumption, because when we petitioned and when we, if going forward, we continue to petition the government, it's because lists have already been made and the conclusion has already been drawn. So the reason we went to the court is because we only went to the court after nominations or appointments had been done. And people were already sitting in cabinet, people already, you know, people were working in the government. So it's not like we went to the court before appointments were made.
What do you think are the prospects of this case against the government?
So, you know, what we would like to see is the government actually following the laws of the country that we're in. The constitution is the highest law in the land, and it must be followed to the letter. In Article 259, it says if a person is given power to make appointments, that person shall ensure. I think you and I understand that the term shall ensure means the person must ensure it's mandatory that there should be 50-50 gender representation, there should be equitable youth representation, and persons with disabilities as well. And young people, for example, make up the majority. It's the largest constituent population-wise in this country. Women make up more than half the population. So you cannot tell me that this is not practicable to do so. And that was a ruling in court a few months ago in July.
Well, some people are saying previous governments have chosen people they think are competent to work with. Secondly, this is the second government that has a female as the vice president. Isn't this enough?
You know, I will keep going back to the law, to the laws of the country, and the fact that even the international instruments that we have domesticated and ratified speak to the fact that we should have 50-50 gender representation. It is not for the sake of just having women in positions of power or in governance. You know, women play a very critical role when it comes to development. In the Ministry of Health, talk about the Ministry of Education. There are so many aspects that I believe could have moved forward. Zambia could have been at a different level had we had women taking up these positions of power. So it's not like women are just, you know, the women's movement is just speaking from without. We have seen it in Rwanda, for example. Talk about Germany. We have seen that there's certain countries where women are taking the lead and things are moving. So why can we not, you know, go in that direction? And for the fact that we have something that backs it up. If we have a piece of law that says 1, 2, 3, we must follow that, especially if the law actually says that this shall be done, this must be done, is mandatory. So it's not that we're just speaking from without. And just having one woman, a vice president, is not enough. It's not like we're competing for the two first positions. It's in the whole lot of the governance structure.
Harriet Chibuta is the executive director of Young Women in Action. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. South African scientists are scrambling to determine how quickly a newly discovered variant of the coronavirus can spread and if it is resistant to vaccines. The new strain has led Britain to reimpose flight bans on six southern African countries, which could deal another heavy blow to their economies. For VOA, Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Coronavirus cases are once again on the rise in South Africa. Amid the spike, several mutations of a new variant called the B11529 have been detected in the country, Botswana, and Hong Kong. It has sparked concern it could compete with the previously dominant Delta variant and trigger another wave of the pandemic. Dr. Michelle Groom is with South Africa's National Institute for Communicable Diseases.
There's the potential that this could be more transmissible and that there is this potential immune escape, but we don't know yet. We are busy conducting some laboratory tests, obviously, where we can have a look at how, you know, this new variant reacts both to serum from people who have been infected previously as well as vaccinated, which will give us a better idea of the potential immune escape.
The uncertainty has prompted travel restrictions. Britain added six African countries to its so-called red list today, requiring quarantine for incoming travelers and temporarily banning flights. The European Union is also looking at halting air travel from Southern Africa. The South African government has called the decisions rushed and raised concerns about the impact on business. The CEO of South Africa's Inbound Tourism Association, David Frost, says the effects will be devastating on the sector.
We got off the red list in October, and it was sorely needed. We've been shut down for over 18 months. You know, the industry really is on its knees. The impact of this is absolutely dire to livelihoods, to families.
While social distancing and mask use can help combat the virus, Dr. Groom also questions the efficacy of travel bans.
We haven't been able to contain the spread initially of the original virus, and all subsequent variants have spread globally. You know, so I think there's limited value in terms of these restrictions.
Instead, she says vaccinating more of the population would help prevent the most severe cases and deaths. Roughly 35% of South Africa's adult population is vaccinated, a figure far below targets of 70%. Figures are even lower across much of the continent. Experts have warned vaccine inequality would create a breeding ground for the virus to mutate. Astrid Haas is an independent urban economist in Kampala, Uganda.
In Europe now, and in North America in particular, they're talking about booster shots and third vaccines, whereas we know now from the WHO that less than 10% of African countries are going to even meet their vaccine target for this year. Just a very sad manifestation of the global vaccine inequity.
In the absence of vaccinations, lockdowns may be on the horizon. Such measures already have taken a harsh economic toll across Southern Africa. Haas says the halt to retail and other services has made it hard for many people to survive.
Particularly with respect to the urban poor, is that a lot of income is used to purchase food, or a high proportion of income is used to purchase food. And when they are not able to make income, then that affects food security as well.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is convening the country's coronavirus council this weekend in response to the new variant. The government says it will announce any new measures in coming days. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection. That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor William Eagle and Producer Tracy Carter, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a mouse that removes the palm nut that turns out to be the bait of a trap would already have known that the palm nut does not ripen on the ground. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.